I'm going to start with two readings this morning, the first of which is called Let Me Die Laughing, and it's by UU Minister Mark Morrison Reed. We are all dying, our lives always moving toward completion. We need to learn to live with death and to understand that death is not the worst of all events. We need to fear not death, but life. Empty lives. Loveless lives. Lives that do not build upon the gifts that each of us has been given. Lives that are like living deaths. Lives which we never take the time to savor and appreciate. Lives in which we never pause to breathe deeply. What we need to fear is not death, but squandering the lives we have been miraculously given. So let me die laughing, savoring one of life's crazy moments. Let me die holding the hand of one I love, recalling that I tried to love and was loved in return. Let me die remembering that life has been good and I did what I could. But today, just remind me that I am dying so that I can live, savor, and love with all my heart. Our second reading is a poem by Mary Oliver called When Death Comes. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn. When death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps his purse shut. When death comes like the measles pox. When death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades. I want to step through the door, full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, toward silence. And each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life, I was a bride married to amazement. I was a bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world. Evelyn was a busy churchwoman who did not expect to ever face what she found herself facing one Sunday afternoon. I was the chaplain on call, and I was about to leave for the night when I stopped to check in with the charge nurse in the intensive care unit. "Oh, I'm glad you stopped," the charge nurse said. "We've been working hard on the guy in 354, and his wife is down the hall waiting. She could use your support." When I found Evelyn, she had tears in her eyes and she looked relieved to see me. She was alone in the family waiting room and her cell phone rang every few minutes while we talked. She told me she'd thought her husband had an infection and that it would be something antibiotics could easily fix. She didn't think he would be admitted to the ICU where he would be intubated and sedated when she drove him to the emergency room that morning. She hoped he would be okay, that he would come out of it. But by the next morning, the doctors had news she didn't want to hear. Multiple organs were failing, and they didn't have much hope that Evelyn's husband would recover. But they said they would wait a few days to see if he changed. He did change. A few days later, when I came back to see Evelyn, her stepdaughter had joined her and they were feeling some relief. The doctors had given them hope. Her husband had improved a little and they would give him more time. Instead of having to make a decision now, they would wait to see how he did and take it one day at a time. As I got to know Evelyn, I learned that her husband's health had been declining over the last 10 years due to a degenerative illness. But Evelyn and her husband did not have advance directives, nor had they ever had a conversation about what they would each want in a situation like this. When I started my residency at Sharp, I was assigned to the Medical Intensive Care Unit. This is the MICU, and like the rest of the hospital, it was designed by architects to be a calming atmosphere, to lower patients' and families' stress and improve their well-being. But no amount of thoughtful design can take away the pressures of the ICU environment. As I walk around the horseshoe-shaped hallway, high-pitched ventilators hiss all around. I peer through oversized sliding glass doors into patients' rooms, hoping to make a visit. But most are dimly lit, patients are sedated, and there's no family around. In the hallways, nurses hurry back and forth from patients' rooms to medicine storage while alarms sound on monitors. It's a place where nobody wants to spend their last days. As a chaplain, I've seen a lot of things I hoped I'd never have to see in my lifetime. I work in a hospital with a level one trauma center, and in our trauma room, I've seen the place where life crosses paths with sudden death. Of all the suffering, some of the most difficult for me to witness has been watching families make agonizing decisions about their loved one's care in the midst of a medical crisis. In the MICU, these situations repeat over and over, day after day, week after week, month in and month out. Evelyn and her husband are not the only ones. As I've learned, this is all too common in our society. 70% of Americans say they want to die at home, but 70% die in hospitals and institutions. 60% say making sure family is not burdened by tough decisions is extremely important. 56% have not communicated their end-of-life wishes. 90% of Americans think it's important to have these conversations, but only 30% have had them. This is the conversation I'm here to talk with you about today. This is not an easy thing to talk about. Facing mortality is an ongoing struggle for me in life and at work. Talking about death is not easier or more fun for a chaplain than it is for anybody else. On the all too frequent days when I work with someone who is confronting the death of a loved one, I come home drained and exhausted. And at the end of a day, it's all I can do to eat a good dinner, get to bed on time, and prepare to do it all again the next day. As the MICU chaplain, I get called when a patient is being withdrawn from life support and the family needs spiritual care. Or when a patient is being withdrawn from life support and there is no family, so the staff need my support. Many of the patients in my unit I never get to meet, because in many cases, they never recover. When I do meet their families, it's often at the 11th hour. This is the call I dread the most. It's the request to support a family facing the decision about whether to remove life support. These calls often come in at the last minute. If I'm lucky, I get wind of the family conference beforehand, so I can hear what the doctor tells the family. Family members do not look to me for answers about what to do in these situations. They want to know what their loved one would want. They want to know that something beyond themselves is in control so that they don't have to play God. They want to know why they are in this situation. Why me? Why now? Why this? There are no simple answers to any of these questions. The "Why Does God Allow Suffering" sermon is a topic for another day. This sermon is about another conversation. It's a conversation many of you have probably thought of having with your loved ones, have wanted to have with your doctor, and you know you need to have with yourself. This conversation is about what you want at the end of your life. So let me tell you honestly, I don't have my advance directive done yet. I have the form, and it's one of the things on our to-do list, along the lines of doing the taxes and finding a financial planner. We did do our taxes. But it's the not fun things that we'll get around to doing when we have to, or whenever we get sick of procrastinating it. Let me be clear about it. We both want to do this, and we know it's important. We just haven't done it yet. We have had a conversation, though. It's an ongoing conversation in our family about what we want in the event of a medical crisis or emergency. And I believe that this conversation is the most important part. This is also a difficult sermon because I know no one wants to talk about death. Some of my patients coping with life-threatening illnesses say they've tried to start these conversations with loved ones who tell them, no, we have to stay positive. We can't talk about death. One of my patients, while waiting months for an organ transplant, told me he was prepared for any outcome, but he worried about some of his family members who didn't want to talk about the possibility that he might die. He told me he thinks that we give death more power over us when we try to avoid the topic. And we do tend to avoid the topic. For those of you who go to work, ask yourself how many times a colleague has mentioned a birth in their family in the past year. What about a death? Death is a part of life everywhere, but in the United States, we rarely see or hear about everyday deaths. I think we can learn a lot about our culture and ourselves when we look at the language we use. Consider how many words we have that allow us to avoid using the words dead or die. Words like gone, lost, passed, let go, checked out. There's many more on the internet if you look. Even in the hospital, I more often hear a word like expired than the word died. I think this points to an important truth. The medical community is really no better at talking about death than the broader culture. In fact, it might even be worse. In his book, Being Mortal, Atul Gawande, a surgeon, writes about how doctors are unprepared to talk about death with their patients. In the last 60 years or so, medicine has changed the very trajectory of our lives. In the past, most people would have a serious medical crisis and die fairly quickly. Now, many of us will have a long, slow decline. Gawande writes, "The waning days of our lives are given over to treatments that addle our brains and sap our bodies for a sliver's chance of benefit. They are spent in institutions, nursing homes, and intensive care units, where regimented, anonymous routines cut us off from all the things that matter to us in life. We have allowed our fates to be controlled by the imperatives of medicine, technology, and strangers. The default in the medical system is to keep people alive at all costs. The system is not set up to allow people to die without their permission. So we go to every extent to keep people alive, sometimes without thought to quality of life. Itil Gawundi has seen how often medicine fails the very people it is supposed to help. I have seen this in the MICU too. Medicine sometimes prolongs death rather than saving life. Remember Evelyn and her husband, who I talked about earlier. Evelyn watched her husband become more and more sick in the ICU over the next 10 days. The intensity of the medical treatments that ICU doctors and nurses use can save lives, but they're also invasive. Over weeks, some treatments can do more harm than good. 2 weeks after she'd brought her husband to the emergency room, Evelyn made the decision to withdraw life support with the help of their adult children and the hospital doctors. For Evelyn, after 2 weeks of giving him a chance, she'd hoped she was doing the right thing. But that didn't mean it was easy for her to make a decision like that without having had a conversation with her husband about what he wanted. Before the withdrawal, she told me, "I just wish I knew what he would want me to do." So the good news is that there's hope that this conversation is changing. I believe we are entering a new era. There's a growing movement to make end-of-life conversations more normal and more comfortable. We've seen that we need to be able to talk openly about dying. One place where the conversation already has changed is La Crosse, Wisconsin. Last year, the NPR show Planet Money ran a story about La Crosse called "The Town Where Everyone Talks About Death." 96% of people who die in La Crosse have an advance directive. In this community, talking about death is a comfortable conversation. Neighbors gossip about who on the block hasn't filled out their advance directive yet. In the story, which I wish I had time for you to play for you today, it's one of those listed on your orange sheet in the order of service, though. A teenage daughter and her father chat about the music they want to play at his memorial service and then laugh about the fact that this is a normal dinner table topic for them. The conversation about death has become so comfortable in La Crosse because of the work of one person. He's a medical ethicist who gets called in to help with conversations about the care of people who don't have advance directives. He noticed that most of the time they were talking about a patient who had been sick for years. And he thought, why not have that conversation earlier? Why not have that conversation earlier? If you take home only one thing from this sermon today, let it be this. Please, please have a conversation before you have a crisis. One of the things that I love most about being a chaplain is that nearly every week I find myself caring for people in some situation I never thought I would witness, and I'm able to make it through. I grow in these times because as I take risks and face my fears, including death, I see that I can walk with people through their most difficult moments, and I won't die. Difficult conversations can be the most liberating. Thinking about death is frightening, but planning ahead leaves more room for peace of mind, not just in our final days, but every day. Reverend Forrest Church teaches us we cannot embrace our lives fully until we find a way to accept our death. We can take back some of death's power when we talk about it. These are conversations I believe will change not just your death, but your life. They will change your loved ones' lives by easing their burden during difficult times. And if more of us start having this conversation, we can spread the idea that talking about death is critical to all our lives. We can change the culture around end-of-life care. These conversations are first and foremost for each of you. They're about aligning your goals with your life. They're about asking yourself, what is most important to me at the end of my life? What are my goals and my fears? What can't I live without? And then sharing your answers with your decision makers, your family, and your doctors. These conversations can bring comfort to the days around your last days. I want to tell you one more story to shine a light on a heavy topic before I close today. One day, I visited a patient who was unexpectedly facing a big decision. Should he go the riskier route and get a heart transplant? Or should he play it safer and get a device implanted to help his diseased heart function better? How do people decide these things? He asked me, the chaplain. I asked him how he wanted to live his life. What did he want to live for? What was he looking forward to? I asked him to consider with his wife and family, what matters most to you? What can't you live without? What are your goals, your fears? What do you understand about your diagnosis? What trade-offs are you willing to make? He was surprised. He had never thought about these questions or discussed them with his wife before. He'd hoped I would give him an answer about what it's like to live with the device or how many people who get transplants survive. But I didn't have an answer to give him. I also didn't have more than 20 minutes or so to spend with him, an average visit length for me in the hospital. I left him and his wife with the questions and hoped they would be able to make a decision together.